This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Kids are naturally impulsive, irrational, manipulative, and even violent. But sometimes serious illness lurks beneath that seemingly normal childish behavior. More than 13 million children in America have mental health disorders. And that's about 1 in 6 kids who suffer from anxiety or depression, eating disorders, bipolar disorder, and other mental illnesses. And those are just the ones who've been diagnosed. Trouble is, it's tough to accurately identify mental illness in children. Just about every kid acts illogically from time to time, so how can families and doctors be sure that something is wrong? And what's the best treatment for brains that are still developing? On today's show, we're going to pose those questions and more to a group of mental health and pediatric experts, and we'd like to hear from you as well. If your child has been diagnosed with a mental illness, or if you suffer from mental or behavioral disorder, now or in your youth, and you want to share your thoughts with us, 877-962-9862. Send us an email at sot@wunc.org. One of the most important studies of mental health in children is underway right here in North Carolina. It's called the Great Smoky Mountain Study. It was launched in Western North Carolina by a team of researchers at Duke, and it tracked 1,400 students from ages 9 to 16, began in 1992. One of the goals is to determine risk factors for developing emotional and behavioral disorders. The subjects are now in their adulthood, and the study is yielding some significant results. Here to talk about it is William Copeland. He's an associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Duke. Bill, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank.
This research study started about 20 years ago. What was the idea at looking at youth and mental health? And so there's two things that are going on here. You're looking at youth and in Western North Carolina. Tell us about all of that.
Right. Well, in order to develop a public policy strategy for addressing children's mental health, you actually need to know how many kids are affected and how often those kids that are affected get treatment. And so what you need is kind of a census of children's mental illness. And there's no national survey that we have right now that kind of keeps this kind of data. Dr. Jane Costello and Adrian Engel decided that they wanted to kind of get a better handle on this. And they wanted to do it in a rural area, as these are kind of historically understudied when it comes to mental health. And so they went out to Buncombe, North Carolina, and approached the school district about recruiting kids for this epidemiologic sample to study mental illness. And they ended up focusing on 11 counties in Western North Carolina and 1,400 kids that were originally ages 9 to 13.
What were the objectives initially in this?
Well, the original goal was to kind of get a handle on what's the total burden of mental illness. How many kids are affected, right, and of those kids that are affected, how many actually get treatment? You know, typically, if you want to get a handle on this, on any sort of prevalence of a disease, you'd kind of go to clinics where they're treated. We can't do this with mental illness because so many kids that have these disorders actually never get any treatment at all.
So what and how much research was available on this subject?
Well, at this time, there was very little. There is kind of a scattering of epidemiologic studies across the U.S. and around the world, but no kind of widespread effort to really get a sense of how many kids are affected by these problems.
Why is that? Why has it taken until now to take this as seriously as this survey seems to be doing?
That's a really good question. I mean, I think without knowing how many kids are affected, it's hard to determine whether this is really kind of priority or something that we should be focusing on. And so part of the goal was of the Great Smoky Mountain Study was to get in there and to determine how many kids are actually affected by these kind of disorders.
And this is a community study. In other words, you're looking at the health of the entire region in a sense, and
right,
it's different from a clinical study. How so and why?
Right. So the kids were chosen just a random sample of 1,400 kids from the area that had no history of psychiatric problems. And the goal was to see what percentage of these kids just in the community would be found to have some sort of issues. And then you can kind of estimate out how many kids in the whole region are affected and determine what kind of services are needed.
And then how do you go about that? How do you obtain a random sample in Western North Carolina?
Yeah. Well, the way that it was done for the Great Smoky Mountain Study was to access the school records. And there's very few private schools out there. So if you can access the public school records, you can get a good sense of all the children in the area. And then involved kind of randomly choosing children from those records and also making sure that you weren't choosing children from the same family.
What about that region itself? When you talk about Western North Carolina, is there anything particular about the demographics there that would distinguish it from other parts of the country?
Yeah. Well, it's certainly a very rural area. And one of the reasons why it was so interesting to begin with is because it's so isolated and it's very difficult to access services in the area. And the thought was that this is really kind of a group of people who are at high risk for not getting the kind of treatment that they need for these kinds of problems.
Now, some of those kids have reached adulthood. What are some of the things you're learning about mental illness in young people?
Yeah. Well, the first thing that we really wanted to get a handle on is just how common this is. And as you kind of quoted at the beginning, the best guess that we have nationwide is that about 1 in 6 or 1 in 7 kids is affected with a mental illness at any given point in time. The next question that you immediately want to ask, though, is of those kids that are affected, what percentage of them are actually getting any kind of treatment which can be helpful for them? And what we found out in Western North Carolina is that it was only about 1 out of every 3 kids with a diagnosable disorder that got any treatment at all. And even those that got treatment often weren't getting the kind of treatment that we would consider to be the gold standard. In fact, very few of them were. So when you think about mental illness, you really have to consider this to be kind of an iceberg sort of a disorder where most of what's going on lies below the surface.
But it raises some even larger questions that your research could shed light on, and that is if so much goes untreated, how much of it needs to be treated? In other words, if I take a snapshot of someone in grief, for instance, who's just lost a loved one, didn't know what the reason was, I might say they're suffering from depression. If I took that snapshot, I'd say, well, you need to treat that. But we know grief is something that we can very often work through with friends. So this is my question. Can this shed light on what actually needs to be treated and what is a kind of a snapshot, kind of acute condition for a child that they may, for lack of a better term, grow out of?
Right, right. I mean, I think in that sense, psychiatric illness is a lot like physical illness. There's a very broad continuum. So you have some sort of physical illnesses like, say, influenza or chickenpox, which are kind of mild and impairing at a given point, but most people recover. And then you have some other kinds of disorders like asthma or like extreme headaches, which can be more longstanding. And then there's a very kind of small group of really more severe conditions, which are chronic and debilitating. And it's very similar picture when we look at mental illness. And there is good evidence that for a lot of kids that have these problems, they do actually get better and sometimes even get better without the aid of formal treatment, you know. And then there's also, a small group of kids, probably about 5% at any given point in time, that really have kind of a chronic and unremitting sort of a form of this, which is going to require, significant intervention.
Is there anything in the survey that you've done, because it is longitudinal, that could shed light on that in terms of identifying a child who may have had a disorder, who's fine now as an adult,
right,
and compare that with a child who is, both of whom were untreated. Let's compare them to 2 untreated children. Another one who isn't doing so well, and say, well, what are the factors that allowed one to go untreated and turn out okay, and another one who now needs some serious help?
Right, right. Because so few of the kids are getting treatment, it's not the case that most of the kids in our study are actually getting better because they're getting effective treatment. But there is this whole gradient of severity that you're dealing with, and some of it you really only get a picture of by kind of studying these people repeatedly over time. And when you see the same folks kind of popping up from year to year with problems, and sometimes different problems from year to year, it's that kind of a chronic course that really seems to predict the kids that are going to have trouble over time. I mean, there's some kids that look, very ill at one point in time, and then they'll come back the next year, and it's a very different picture. So if you want to understand mental illness, you really need to kind of follow these kids long term.
I'm talking with Bill Copeland, an associate professor at Duke's Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences. And right now I'd like to bring his colleague into the conversation, Dr. Helen Egger. She is the head of the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry with the Duke Preschool Mental Health Program. Hello, Helen Egger. Good to
Hi.
Talk to you.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Sure. Maybe we could have you help us with some of the terms, because I've been going back and forth between mental illness and behavioral disorder. Are they the same thing? How do you distinguish these things?
Yeah, mental illness or psychiatric disorders is the broad term that encompasses many specific types of disorders. And often people divide disorders into emotional disorders, which would be anxiety disorders, and depression or bipolar disorder, and then behavioral disorders, which would include impairing disruptive behavior problems and attention deficit disorder. There, of course, are another realm of disorders, the autism and pervasive developmental disorders that are less common, so they're in the group as well.
How about language, the language we use around this when we're describing disorders of children? Do we try to use different language because we're concerned about stigma?
No. In fact, the work that my group has done really jumped off from the Great Smoky Mountain study, in which there was a realization that starting at 9 really was, in a way, too late because these disorders start earlier. So over the last decade, we've been building a program of how to reliably and validly assess psychiatric disorders in children 2 to 5 years old, really to look at the very early roots. And one question that we've addressed is, do disorders look the same in very young children as they do in older children, adolescents, or adults? And are the rates similar or are the rates different? And what we've actually found is that the rate of disorders in very young children is about 10%, which is about the same as the rate in older children and adults. And these findings have now been replicated using a psychiatric interview we developed. It's been replicated in Germany, in Norway, in Romania, in Canada, and some other studies in the U.S. So that really suggests, certainly to our group and our interest, that if we can identify these disorders early, maybe we really can prevent the severe impairment or even the chronicity that we're seeing in older children.
Talking about mental health disorders in children, 877-962-9862 is the number to call if you want to join the conversation. If you have a child with a disability, with a an emotional problem or a mental disorder, give us a call, 877-962-9862. We'd like to hear your story. Or if you yourself were diagnosed as a child, call us or send us an email at sot@wnc.org. Helen, you talk about the fact that you know now that, roughly the same percentage of children, young children, have disorders as up the age continuum. But what are the challenges in diagnosing mental illness in children so young?
And there are many challenges, some of which we have gotten some of a handle on and many that we need to continue to work on. I'll give you the example of attention deficit disorder, and I always joke that, you know, every preschooler is impulsive, inattentive, and hyperactive. How the heck are you going to identify ADHD in these very young children? But what we see when we assess these symptoms is that it's very common for young children to have one or two of the symptoms that are the criteria for ADHD. But actually, it's very uncommon for children to have them at the number, which is 7 or above, needed for a diagnosis. It's only about 3% of the kids. And what is important is that the kids that meet the criteria there, we're not just putting a label on them, which people are concerned about. In fact, those children are highly impaired already. So, for example, of our preschoolers with ADHD, 45% have already been suspended from preschool at least once. 15% have been expelled from preschool at least once. And they're impaired not only in their relationship with their parents and their daycare provider, but also with their peers and with their siblings. So this really points to the fact that we're really interested in identifying impairing illness in these children, not putting labels on kids. And the reason is that we want to be able to provide treatment for these children and families who are experiencing a lot of distress and a lot of impairment in the child's normal development.
Well, and then, of course, questions arise around where these stresses and difficulties arise. And, Bill, I think there's something fascinating about your study because the Eastern Band of the Cherokee were included in the study over an interesting period of time. Tell us about what you found in that group.
Yeah. Well, the Quala Boundary Reservation is located in western North Carolina within this 11-county area that we were studying. And so the Cherokee Indians were a really important part of the study from the get-go in 1992. And in 1996, they received authorization to open a casino on the reservation. And as part of that agreement, there was also an understanding that every man, woman, and child that was part of the tribe would receive a portion of the profits. And this was kind of doled out every 6 months, and it started very small and increased over time, such that in the year 2001, every person in the tribe would get about $6,000 a year from the profits of the casino. And the Cherokee Indians is also a group where there is kind of widespread poverty. And so one of the things that we became interested in was how this influx of cash for these families would affect how their children were doing. And in some cases, it meant the difference between being impoverished and being, you know, kind of moving above that kind of federal poverty threshold.
All right. So they had more money. Is there any correlation then in terms of their mental health outcomes as a result that you
Right. I mean, you could really kind of see it going a number of different ways. Just giving people money isn't necessarily thought to be anything that is going to help in all cases. But what we found is that for the children in these families, when we looked at them a couple of years after the casino opened and their families had been receiving the stipend, we saw lower levels of certain types of psychiatric problems, particularly the behavioral problems that Dr. Egger was talking about. And it seemed to be the case that part of this was explained by the fact that the parents had more time to spend with the children, more time to kind of monitor their activities and do the things that parents do. And this was a very helpful thing, something that we've kind of followed up now 5 to 10 years later, and we can still see differences in these kids functioning that were able to kind of use this cash to kind of lift their families out of poverty.
Helen, is there any correlation between wealth or socioeconomic status and mental health in children?
Yes, certainly. I mean, and there is, that is one of the key risk factors that can affect a child and increase their chances of having a mental illness. So poverty, as well as living in neighborhoods where they experience violence, and of course, other kinds of traumas like child abuse, and, you know, any of the risk factors that are affecting older children. The work has been done extensively in the Great Smoky Mountain Study. We're finding that those risk factors are unfortunately common in very young children and also have the very same correlation with psychiatric disorders in very young children.
And I know that you have been working on an MRI study with children as young as 5 years old. Can you describe that for us?
Yes, this is a study that grows out of our large community study of preschool anxiety disorders, where we screened almost 4,000 parents of 2 to 5 year olds in pediatric primary care clinics, did extensive interviews with 1,000 parents, brought 500 of those kids into our lab to do observational assessment, eye tracking. And now, for the last 3 years, I've been following 200 of these young children doing a functional and structural fMRI study where we're doing brain scans with these children every year. And we will also be assessing their mental health status at each of these times. And so this enables us to ask questions that have been asked with older children and with adults, which is, do we see differences in the neural substrates and in the brain functioning of very young children diagnosed with anxiety disorders, the same differences that we see in adolescents and adults? And the importance and the exciting part of this study is there's so little brain imaging work on typically developing children. So we're going to be able to make some contributions not only about brain development in children with anxiety disorders, but also brain development in children who are having a typical developmental pathway.
Well, we're going to take a break right now, come back with this conversation, and we're going to take your phone calls when we return, talking with Dr. Helen Egger and Bill Copeland of Duke's Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences, and your phone calls at 877-962-9862. We're going to talk about treatment options for mentally ill children and the controversy over medicating kids, all when we return to The State of Things. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. More than 13 million children in America have been diagnosed with a mental illness. Identifying why a child is behaving violently or irrationally can be a relief to some families. But choosing how to treat psychiatric disorders is a harrowing process. We're talking about mental health in children on today's program. My guests are Dr. Helen Egger, head of the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry with the Duke Preschool Mental Health Program. Also with us is Bill Copeland, an associate professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Duke. And joining us now to talk about medical treatment and therapy is Dr. Jim Jensen. He's an associate professor of clinical psychiatry at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine. Jim, welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. Good to be here.
Also with us is Dr. Stephen Dickstein. He is a pediatric psychopharmacologist with the Child Mind Institute, which is a nonprofit organization based in New York. Stephen Dickstein, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And Susan Davis is here as well. Her 8-year-old son was diagnosed with bipolar disorder a little less than a year ago. He's been in various forms of therapy for behavioral disorders since he was 5. Susan is the senior producer of The State of Things. Hello, Susan.
Hi, Frank.
And we're taking your phone calls. SOT@WNC.org is the email address. The phone number is 877-962-9862. Susan, let me start with you. When did your son's behavior first become a concern to you?
Well, in preschool, when he was about 4, he started being sort of chronically difficult. And when he was 5 is when we sought out a diagnosis. And between 4 and 5, my husband and I went through what a lot of people went through, which is trying to rationalize it. And we would call him like the world's smallest pain in the butt and things like that, thinking, well, everybody knows a grown-up who's a pain in the butt, and that person was 4 once. And finally, when we were visiting my family, my brother, who has 2 grown or older sons, took me aside and he said, no, something's wrong with him. And so it doesn't have to be that way. Your job is to help him, get him some help. Stop saying that he's this way or that way and there's nothing to be done about it. Face it and get some help. And we did. We came back. My son was 5, and we sought all kinds of assessment and diagnosis. It was another 2 years before we got the diagnosis of bipolar. We first got diagnosis of sensory integration disorder and a kind of OCD thinking, high anxiety. There are so many of these things that are comorbid that go together. And it's very hard in kids to tease out what behavior goes with what disorder.
What kind of treatment options were you getting?
So we sought out occupational therapy for the sensory integration disorder, and that is incredibly effective and really helpful. And sensory integration disorder means your child often goes into a fight or flight mode based on various information they process through their senses. With my son, there were all kinds of touches and smells he couldn't handle. And what you need to know is that this is my baby. He's, to me, delicious, and I couldn't touch him. I couldn't kiss him. I really couldn't hold him. It's incredibly painful as a mom. It's also really isolating for the child. So the OT was really effective in just bringing touch into both of our lives.
You couldn't do those things when he was in that state. It's not like you never.
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 Never. It's really debilitating.
And you had to be, but if it hadn't been for some kind of clinician, no mother or parent would intuit this.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. And it takes a while of kissing your son and him going, no, don't kiss me, before you think, what's wrong with me? Something must be wrong with him. And you get him some help. Now, with the bipolar disorder, we went ahead with medication and have had great results. You know, what we were told about bipolar disorder is that it's different pediatrically in pediatric cases than it is in grown-ups. But it is a cycle of mania and depression, sometimes in a single day. And he suffers what a lot of grown-ups with bipolar suffer. He can be grandiose. He can be delusional. And, you know, kids are wildly imaginative. So detecting a delusion in a child is really, really hard.
Well, Dr. Jim Jensen, what do we do? What are the treatment options for bipolar, for instance?
Well, for bipolar disorder, the most important thing really is the diagnosis initially, just to make sure. It's been sort of a fad diagnosis over the past 10 years or so, and many more kids have gotten the diagnosis than have the disorder. And so the most important thing is getting the right diagnosis, making sure that they have the core symptoms of mania, which are required for the diagnosis in children as they are in adults, such as not needing sleep, not just having difficulty sleeping, but not actually needing sleep. And also racing thoughts, flight of ideas, rapid speech.
Stephen Dickstein, we've talked about the challenge of accurately diagnosing. Once we make that decision, we've got the diagnosis. What about medicine? That can be a tough choice for families, can it?
Absolutely. I think families who come to a child psychiatrist are often are not happy about coming there. They've already tried to explore lots of other options, and then faced with the prospect of medication, it really raises a lot of people's anxiety. And I think it's a combination of things. I think the hard part is that, you know, there's a lot of media presentation about the bad effects or the over-medication of children. And I think, you know, just as Dr. Jensen was saying, that the real key is that if you can try to get an accurate diagnosis, then at least we have some evidence about what's a reasonable treatment that usually helps with that diagnosis. But I think the tricky part is really that lots of kids come in because they're difficult. And I think teasing apart, especially in younger kids, like Dr. Egger looks at, is, you know, what part of the difficult part are they struggling with, and what are the core features, and then what kind of medication is going to be right for them, if a medication is going to be right for them at all.
Let's go out to the phones right now, and Mary, Marksville, Virginia, Mary is on the line. Hello, Mary.
Hello, thank you. I'd just like to make a plea personally for help for the children. I'm 65. I had polio and acquired mild chronic depression probably when I was 7. I didn't get diagnosed until I was 43. I wasn't diagnosed with ADD until I was 57. My school life and to a certain extent my social life was pretty bad, and I went to college because I was afraid to go. It was terrible. I just can't imagine how you wouldn't get help for kids.
Thanks for that call, Mary. 877-962-9862. Let me talk with you, Jim Jensen. What would have been the intervention? How would we have known at age 7 that Mary was suffering from depression and not just, you know, going into some kind of early adolescence or something that, you know, kids often do?
Well, depression in kids sometimes looks a little different than it does in adults. We oftentimes see irritability as a major symptom. More so than in adults. Kids have so much energy that we don't often see them just sort of moping around, although sometimes we see that as well. But it's a matter of trying to put the whole picture together, and with the core caveat that when we're diagnosing an illness in children, we're looking for functional impairment. So there needs to be the symptoms there, and in addition, that it is impairing them in some major aspect of their life.
Bill Copeland, if we think about the kind of research you're doing, some kids would have shown those symptoms, and they're going to come out the other end, and they will not have endured and gone through what Mary seems to have gone through. They will have found another way, even though they didn't get treatment. Is there any way of knowing what distinguishes when a child who has this these early signs truly needs treatment, and when there are just other means by which they make their way through life and don't show the kind of symptoms that Mary has?
Yeah, in order to make that kind of judgment, we need to be kind of monitoring this behavior to begin with. And one of the problems, along with, you know, the difficulty with making diagnosis, is that many of these kids aren't seen to begin with. And often that's the parent that has to make that judgment, and they may not necessarily know what's normal or abnormal and may be kind of reticent to take that step. And so we really have a problem with identifying these kids to begin with and coming up with some system that's better than requiring the parents to kind of identify it and to find their way to a clinic. A lot of kids are being missed.
Well, let me ask you, Susan, you suggested that it was pretty difficult for you to actually make that choice. What were your worries? What were your concerns about going to see the professionals?
There are a couple of things. One is just the simple fact that something's wrong with your child. And it's very hard. I remember the day my husband said that out loud, that he was able to say there's something wrong with our son. It's very hard. It's scary because nobody, especially a very, very good clinician, physician, nobody will tell you how it's going to go because they can't and they shouldn't. So you have tremendous anxiety. You don't know if they're going to wind up institutionalized or if they're going to be Steve Jobs, you know, and these are all possibilities, especially with bipolar, which is linked to so much success in this country. It's hard. You also realize very quickly how isolating it is for them, how lonely your child is going to be. And one thing that people don't understand is that I live in Chapel Hill in a very educated community, and my child has an IEP, an individual education plan, in the Chapel Hill schools. And there are so many well-meaning, well-intentioned, well-educated, brilliant people on his side. And still, I have to take those people with me every day. I have to carry all of them. I'm not just bearing the weight of my son. My husband and I aren't just carrying him through life. We're carrying all these people through life to educate them, to bring them along, to keep them on his side. It is exhausting. It's daunting. Even if you have tremendous resources, emotionally, even financially, which I have. I wouldn't say tremendous financially, but I have all the resources anybody needs. I live between two major research universities, and still, every day is a challenge. And knowing that makes you think, no, there's nothing wrong with him.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to make that take that step. Let's go to the Outer Banks. Caroline Rose is on the line. Hello, Caroline Rose.
Hi. I'm calling because my daughter, she was diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder when she was 10 years old, which manifested itself in an eating disorder. And we started treatment or tried to find help immediately, but could not find the right type of treatment. But I am encouraged to hear that you're doing research when they're, in hindsight, I could tell that when she was born, she was different from my older daughter. She was extremely sensitive to touch, to light, to sound, and later to feelings. I mean, you couldn't reprimand her. She couldn't stand wind on her face. But anyway, she died after when she was 23 years old. But so I'm really interested in hearing that you're studying the brains of children when they're really young, because I feel like that had I been able to see something before she actually started restricting her eating, then perhaps there would have been a chance to treat her better. And also the treatment for eating disorders then, I don't know how it is now, but if she got sicker with treatment, not better.
Caroline Rose, first of all, I'm sorry for the loss of your daughter, and thank you very much for calling in. I wonder if I can put the question or that story to Dr. Stephen Dickstein and talk about sort of what are the options for parents in those situations, have things gotten better since over the past 23 years?
Yeah, no, it's a heartbreaking story, and I think that really talks about the why we need to have more availability of sound evidence-based treatments. I think that certainly with obsessive compulsive disorder, we know in the last 20 years, looking at what treatments work, what treatments are effective, we know that certainly cognitive behavioral therapy and also the antidepressant, the SSRI medications, can be extraordinarily effective, whereas other treatments don't seem to work. And I think that the hope is that certainly things have improved over the last 20 years, but that we're still at a stage where it's really, I think, as Ms. Davis was presenting, it's hard to predict who's going to respond to what treatment. We know that there are a number of different effective treatments for different disorders, but I think that picking the right treatment is a hard step, as well as having the availability of people that are capable of doing, what the evidence-based effective treatments are. Certainly, like cognitive behavioral therapy, especially for anxiety disorders and OCD, seems to be effective when other types of therapy just isn't. And I think that, again, trying to be wise and figure out who's going to respond to what treatment is really the challenge of what we do in our field.
Well, and let me, Jim Jensen, let me turn this around a little bit, because you hear a complaint from some parents that, in fact, it's the treatment that's used in the diagnostics. We'll try this. If they respond to it, it means they had that. And is there a danger that treatment itself is becoming a diagnostic tool and you're sort of throwing it at the wall to see what sticks?
Well, I think that's something that we like to get away from. That's why this research is so important. We would like a good diagnosis before we go in with treatment. And the importance of the treatment is really stems from the idea that children are remodeling their brains. And we would like them to be remodeling that on the basis of supportive family, good educational experience, good friends, rather than on the basis of depression or mania or OCD or whatever it might be.
And it also brings – Dr. Dixty, maybe I'll ask you this question, whether or not withholding treatment once the diagnostic process begins, waiting a little while is ever in order or ever wise in the event that what you're looking at is simply a developmental issue or something unique to the child and not particularly significant in terms of their long-term outcome.
I mean, I think it definitely depends on how impaired they are with what they're suffering from. And I think the unfortunate part is that most people have already waited before they get to see a clinician. So at least a lot of the data is that most people will wait like 2 years before actually going to see someone. So, you know, I think in some cases we're mostly, especially as a child psychiatrist and as a clinician, we're mostly seeing kids that have already waited. I think the question, you know, you're asking is, you know, certainly when you identify it in a pediatric office or you identify in the school setting where kids are not already identified as having a major difficulty, you know, trying to figure out which kids are going through a developmental stage and will pass out of it, or which kids are going through an adjustment to grief and will pass out of it. I think that's the tricky part. And luckily, we do have criteria that if symptoms go on, in, you know, for example, for PTSD, going beyond 2 months, and if those traumatic symptoms are still there, then we know that it's less likely to go away on its own. But I think it gets down to, as Dr. Jentz was saying, how impaired is the child, and what's the risk of not doing something compared to the risk of treatment.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Dr. Stephen Dixtein is a pediatric psychopharmacologist with the Child Mind Institute based in New York. You can find out more at childmind.org. Dr. Jim Jensen, an assistant professor of clinical psychiatry at UNC School of Medicine. Susan Davis lives in Chapel Hill. Her 8-year-old son has bipolar disorder. She is our senior producer on The State of Things. Dr. Helen Egger is also an associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Duke University, along with her colleague Bill Copeland. They were both on the program. Bill Copeland, an associate professor in that department. And that's our program for today. Thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.